I'm really excited to be here. This is the first time I've actually presented this research, so I'm quite excited to talk about it. So as Aaron said, this is a project that has been, it's part of a project, the findings study are part of a project that have been funded by the International Inequalities Institute. It's looking at private tutoring in what I've called here, what I'm calling today the extreme case of South Korea. Factors that have underpinned a major growth of private tutoring in Korea over several decades. Also the effectiveness, or rather otherwise, of Korean government policies that have been trying for many years to curb parental demand for private tutoring in the Korean context. What I've done for the project, I carried out interviews with a number of policy experts and key education stakeholders in Korea. The reason why I did this is because private tutoring is a phenomenon which you're probably aware, it's a phenomenon that's growing across Europe and across the world, actually. It has implications, major implications for educational inequalities. And I wanted to see what sorts of lessons, specifically England, I've done a lot of research on privatisation in England, might draw from the Korean case. So I'm going to talk today about a particular subset of my findings, which relate to a particularly strong emphasis that was placed by Korean interviewees on the issue of selective schooling. High school entrance exams are an issue that are currently of pretty major relevance in England. The reason for this is that ever since 2016, Theresa May's Conservative government in the UK has been seeking to, because there's been limited success with this, but seeking to expand what are currently existing restricted, academically selective elements in English secondary education. So in England in the present day, there are currently 163 selective grammar schools. These are schools which, when students get to the age of 11, they take a test of ability, and the most able students or the most high-achieving students are selected for those schools. These schools have got a long history in English education. In the 50s and the 60s, they were very widespread. However, over the course of the late 60s and the 70s, most of these were abolished, or rather transformed into all-ability comprehensive schools, eventually leaving only around 163. And then in 1998 in this country, the Labour government put a ban, a formal ban, on there being any new selective schools opened. However, since 2016, Theresa May has been seeking to because she hasn't actually done it, but seeking to overturn that ban for new selective schools. Now, in early 2017, when I started writing this paper, there were some quite ambitious plans for by the Conservatives for opening a number of new selective schools. These have actually, they've gone a bit quiet on this ever since the June election, and the Conservatives not doing as well as they had hoped to do. So we've seen those plans have disappeared slightly. However, there are still plans to extend selection in English education. One selective school, Sevenoaks in Kent, has recently opened a selective annex 10 miles from its original, its main site. And this is seen as being a new grammar school in some respects, and it's viewed as being the first one for 50 years. So, and there are also proposals for more satellite campuses of grammar schools in England. And if those happen and those expand, we will see some expansion of the amount of selective schooling there is in England. So the Conservatives believe that this will help to extend opportunity to everyone, not just the privileged few. However, here it is worth noting that grammar schools in England currently, their intake, only 2.5% is eligible for free school meals, so means-tested benefits. That compares with a 13.2% average for state schools in England overall. And education systems across the world which do earlier stratifications, so earlier tracking of students at about age 11, they're known to be more socially stratified, more socially segregated. And while selective schools, they may offer positive effects for some of the children who get in, if they're from more disadvantaged backgrounds, they can be beneficial. However, for the students who don't within fully selective systems, there can be important negative effects on their education, the students who are left behind in selective systems, if you like. Now, debates about selection in English education, historically they focused on questions like who gets in and what happens to the students who do and what happens to the students who don't. Another key facet of the debates more recently, though, has also been about the means by which families are accessing selective schools. Possibilities, for example, that we could see an arms race, Laura McInerney's called it an arms race of private tuition beginning to expand, a private supplementary tuition. The private tutoring industry in England, Scotland and Wales together is already estimated at being about £2 billion. And research by Arson and Rushforth here from 2011, but it has shown that school entrance exams are one key reason given for why parents deploy private tutors in primary school for their children. Here's a graph from the Sutton Trust. This is data that shows that private tutoring has already been on the rise in this country since at least 2005. This is supplementary private tutoring outside of children's school hours. These are 11 to 16-year-olds who have ever engaged with a private tutor. In 2005, the proportion was around 18%. 2016, it's gone up to 25%. And actually, this comparable figure here for London alone was actually 42%. So 42% of 11 to 16-year-olds in London at the moment have had private tutoring at some point. Right, we might ask next, well, so what, actually? Is private tutoring even a problem? Mark Bray, who's a very famous writer writing in this area, and Ora Kuo, they've argued that private tutoring across the world is a problem, it's an issue, rather, about which governments prefer not to know too much. The reason being that private education, private tutoring, tops up public spending on education. It could also be argued to contribute to shifting norms away from the tax, about who should pay for education, so away from the taxpayer towards individual families. And implications for inequality, they do arise from private tutoring because families clearly have unequal capacities to pay for that private tutoring. And for lower income families who find themselves in a situation of being compelled to pay for private tutoring, that can create major financial burdens. And we might think that middle class spending, why would working class families be compelled to do this? Why? Because middle class families, you know, they might be spending money on something that doesn't work anyway. Does it even make a difference? Is it effective? And the findings on private tutoring, they are mixed. It is of variable quality and variable effectiveness, but there have been, in several countries, quite regular studies showing positive effects on student achievement from private tutoring. So in England, the Sutton Trust, which has in recent years been funding research on private tutoring, they have recommended that in order to counter inequality implications, they've said that there should be means-tested government vouchers, give money to lower-income families so that they can spend money on private tutoring. They also encourage initiatives like non-profit private tutoring or pro bono work among for-profit private tutors. In 2009, there was an initiative, a government initiative called the Making Good Progress Initiative. This was involving state schools having pots of money that they could spend on deploying private tutors for struggling state school students. And more recently, pupil premium money in English state schools has been spent on the same thing. There was a recent Guardian report that actually said that some English schools were spending up to £1,400 a day on private tutors for struggling students. At the same time, though, Mark Bray has warned against this notion of free samples with private tutoring because he argues that it can condition families into having certain consumption habits with regard to private tutoring that ultimately they will end up paying for privately when the state money proves to be not enough or it runs out. And within education, we also hear about these theories of maintained inequalities. So however much lower income families spend, higher income families will always be able to spend more. They may well ratchet up their spending. And within what's available, they'll also be the ones who are most likely to be able to navigate the market best and to secure the best quality within what's available. Stephen Ball has also talked about this concept of hyper-developmentalism. Dangers that we might endlessly end up having more and more being spent on tutors, children spending longer and longer hours, longer numbers of hours, rather, with tutors, as families are struggling to maintain competitive positional advantage for their kids. Now, South Korea. South Korea is a fascinating extreme case in these terms. So 2.9% of the country's GDP is made up of families' private spending on what they call shadow education, outside of the formal school system. This is some of the highest spending on private tutoring in the world. Public school spending on school-level education in Korea is only 3.6% of GDP, so it's getting towards public spending levels. This is a picture here of Gangnam in Seoul. And these signs that you see, all the signs on the sides of the buildings, these are mostly signs for cram schools. They're called hagwons, private institutions where children go after they finish normal school for the day. And attendance at these hagwons and private one-to-one tutoring, online tutoring, is so extensive that it's widely considered in Korea to be what Chung has called the enemy of the public school system. In the Korean mainstream media, we see depictions and discourses of an education system that is in crisis. We see stories of children who are working from 7 a.m. through to midnight. They're working all weekend on study. Mental health problems among young people, huge financial sacrifices being made by parents. Now, because Korea is such an extreme case on private tutoring, it's arguably quite fertile ground for exploring hypotheses about the sorts of factors that might drive private tutoring in a society. Governments in Korea over time have become really interestingly very attuned to looking at the levels of private tutoring, monitoring the spending, and seeing how those coincide with different sorts of policies that have been put in place. So as well as trying to understand the drivers of demand, they've also been trying to sort of look at, well, which policies might make a difference, which policies seem to have had some sort of impact, and trying to evaluate those. Examples of the kinds of policies that have been put in place, we've seen curfews being placed for children, 10 p.m. curfews, if you can believe children actually, you know, wanting to study beyond 10 p.m. 10 p.m. curfews, caps on the fees for that the hagwons charge, publicly subsidised after-school programmes, a national education broadcasting service system. So lots of different initiatives. And actually, in the 1980s, commercial private tutoring in Korea was actually formally banned. It was made illegal. Though over the course of the 1990s, that ban was relaxed in different ways and in stages. And in the year 2000, it was formally declared unconstitutional and overturned. Particularly prominent debates, though, can be seen in Korea around the role of school entrance exams and college entrance exams in driving families' shadow education spending. Now, these debates are incredibly complex, and I mean, I can't possibly do justice to all of them in the time I've got today. However, I do want to highlight some key points about school entrance exams, at least in Korea, that are relevant for what I'm going to say today. So the first of these is that in the early 1960s in Korea, not everyone could go to middle or high school. It wasn't universally available. The schools that did exist were accessible only through highly competitive entrance exams. After that, in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, we saw a rise of universalised middle and high school in Korea. However, at the same time as universalisation, there was also a move towards abolishing and equalising what had begun to emerge as hierarchies of schooling. And concerns were growing in the 60s, as early as the 60s, that private tutoring costs were expanding because families didn't just want their kids to get into any high school, they wanted to go to the top high schools. So we saw allocations of pupils to schools by random lotteries. Korea even banned entrance exams in private schools, not just in public schools. So it was all controlled admissions, controlled equalised admissions. However, backlash against that, and since the 1970s, we've seen a regrowth of schools that operate outside those equalisation rules, a re-emergence of selection, of schools having autonomy to select their students. Not all, but a number of schools who can. So with all these that change over time then, what do Korean experts think about the relationship over time between selective schooling and private tutoring expenditures? Do they think that in their society, at least, there is a relationship? And if so, what is the nature of that relationship? So in February 2017, I went to Korea and I spent 3 weeks there carrying out semi-structured interviews with a number of policy experts and key stakeholders in the system. Some of these interviews were in English, others were with the aid of an interpreter because I don't speak Korean. I had two interpreters who helped me with a lot of the interviews. I spoke to 29 people in total. About half of them were people, interviewees on their own. Some were in small groups when I went to a particular organisation. The interviewees included former ministers of education, current advisors in the Ministry of Education, government researchers, some politicians from the National Assembly, and people from Seoul Metropolitan Office of Education, that's the local government in Seoul, teacher union representatives, people from NGOs, education NGOs, representatives from the private tutoring industry itself, and finally some education academics. At the time when I was in Korea, it was actually just after the impeachment of... Yeah, sorry.
Just a clarification question.
Yeah.
So is the exam that hard? Does the students must study that long until like midnight? Or maybe there's some kind of mechanism, let's say public school teachers are actually providing the same tutoring after the school. So it's like there's some expectation for students to actually take these classes to perform well.
Sorry, lots going on there.
I'm trying to understand why would students like spend the whole day preparing for the exam or for this high-stake exam. Is it because the exam is so hard that they just... Like,
yes, and I will come on to that. Okay. But yes, is the answer. Well, you'll see. There is not one single exam is another issue. But I will come on to this in my findings. But this is who I spoke to, basically. Worth saying as well, in terms of political persuasions of these people, up until February 2007 or March 2017, there was a conservative Senuri government in Korea. The people that I spoke to here were working under a conservative government. However, the National Assembly politicians that I spoke to, they were Minju. They were from the centre left, the Democrats, if you like, in Korea. And actually, the Minju president won the election in May 2017, Moon Jae-in. Seoul Metropolitan Office of Education is known for being to the left of the national government, as is certainly the KTU teacher union. In terms of the NGOs, I spoke to both left-wing and right-wing NGOs, and I also gathered a large number of documents from all these organisations, which heavily weighed down my suitcase on the way home. One very final issue I want to speak to just before I go on to talk about the findings relates to how far South Korea and England might be considered comparable. So Western debates on education these days, they're very fond of citing references from East Asia. They're very fond of saying, how can we look to East Asia and learn lessons? This is because East Asian education systems, they tend to fare very highly in international performance rankings like the PISA, the OECD's PISA scores. At the same time, though, context is crucial here. South Korea and England are two very different countries, specifically with respect to private education, private tutoring rather. There are very many factors in Korean society that may well be very strong drivers of private tutoring in Korea that might not particularly apply so much in England. That's not to say that there won't be common factors, but we must be mindful of the differences too. I've just listed a few here. This notion of competitive education fever is an important one. This is something that's referred to all the time, education fever in Korea. And what it refers to is an arguably culturally distinct, almost obsession with education specifically in Korea, though also in other parts of East Asia, that we don't necessarily see elsewhere. It stems partly from Confucianism, Confucian traditions. Also, in Korea, they talk about hakbul traditions, which this is where major credentials and rewards are conferred specifically onto people who make it to not just a good uni, but the top, top uni in society, and the top, top, the top three unis, and the top, top employers. Also, since the Asian financial crisis in the 1990s in Korea, there has been quite a dramatic rise in inequality in society, falling social mobility too. This is from a situation where Korea was previously not particularly an unequal society. So there's a strong sense of changing social fabric there, a lot of authors talk about. And that's led many to say that education fever in recent decades could have become fueled and really escalated beyond what we'd ever seen before. In terms of Korea's education system, it's fair to say also that this is a country with lower education spending as a proportion, public spending as a proportion of GDP than England has. It's also an education system that's known for having a heavily standardised, overloaded curriculum historically, a lot of reliance on things like multiple choice testing that don't give teachers a huge amount of scope for creativity. And all of these factors might be things that in themselves have driven a rise of private tutoring in Korea. At the same time, there are still reasons why we might compare these two societies. And actually, some of these differences, I would argue, shouldn't be overstated in terms of how wildly different they are from what we see in England. Competitive education and fever in Korea might be very extreme. However, it's not non-existent here. Academics like Stephen Ball have for years been writing about growing middle-class obsessions with education, particularly as we move more towards being knowledge economies. Trends like that in England are already, and we've already seen rising private tutoring in England, and those types of trends in society might be behind those sorts of existing rises. England in the 20th century has not seen anything like the same expansion of educational inequality, of societal inequality that Korea has. However, that's not because England is a strongly egalitarian country. It's simply always been more unequal. In 2015, even, it had a higher Gini coefficient than Korea did. In terms of public education spending, the UK does spend 4.2% of its GDP publicly on education. However, Korea spends 3.6, they're not a million miles apart. And it's also worth noting that education spending in England is currently falling. Okay, so things that we are spending less over time in England. In terms of pedagogy, curriculum and assessment, there are some quite major differences here. However, like in England, we are also seeing trends like more demanding school curricula over time, growing reliance on final exams, teachers in state schools having their scope for creativity restricted in various ways. I wouldn't profess to say that this is the same as Korea. I'm just pointing out that the English education system is not without its problems in these regards. Overall, I think we should always be bearing in mind the differences, but that shouldn't stop us from drawing some tentative comparisons. Okay, findings. I'm going on to findings. First of all, the 1970s equalisation of high schooling in Korea, the high school equalisation policy. So this was a policy that involved an abolition of entrance exams, like I said before. It's a policy which in Korea, one certainly gets the sense, and it's confirmed in opinion poll after opinion poll, that this is a policy that has had long-standing majority support in Korea. Equalised schooling as a general concept is seen as being a popular thing. And interviewees in my study, they did speculate that this is because it has historically been associated with families having some relief from prior pressure to spend. on private tutoring, at least at the point of high school access for their kids. That early pressure in the 60s and 70s in Korea was invariably partly because equalisation came at the same time as universalisation. Sometimes families at that time were spending on private tutoring to access high school at all, not just a top high school. However, even after universalisation, the support for that concept of equalisation has endured over time. So that's an important point to note. Now, that sentiment and belief, many interviewees did also state, however, that it's impossible to know for a fact whether or not high school equalisation in the 1970s in Korea did actually lower private tutoring costs. It's very difficult to disentangle the effect of equalisation from the effect of universalisation, for one thing. Over the 1970s in Korea, private tutoring spending didn't go down. It actually went up. However, that was also a time of growing affluence in Korea. There was more spending happening generally, so people might have wanted to spend more on private tutors, whether they had to or not. The high school equalisation policy was a policy that was only implemented gradually over the course of the 1970s, so we never saw, arguably, its full effects. And as early as 1980, private tutoring was banned, commercial private tutoring was banned, so we don't have reliable data for, you know, of several years in terms of what would have happened. So some interviewees in my study, in this context, and we are talking about a situation where people just have to share their views on what happened here because the data is unreliable. Some did say that abolishing high school entrance exams in the 70s probably only ever led to what they call balloon effects in Korea. What that means is a postponing of the social sorting until the point of college entrance. So you squeeze the balloon here, it expands over here. So students at age 12, 13, they were not spending so much on private tutoring. But get to 16, 17, the pressure has grown in terms of university access. At the same time, though, spending more at 16, 17 doesn't necessarily mean spending more across your whole lifetime, across your whole school career. And it's also worth noting that in Korea today, where areas have stayed more true to the 1970s high school equalisation policy, private tutoring costs among middle school students, age 12 to 15-ish, they do have lower private tutoring costs on average. So there is some evidence to suggest a lowering of costs earlier.
Can I just say, so all these cram schools and the private tutoring that's going on even at the younger ages, it's all geared toward getting into university, or is some of it tutoring to stay afloat in your high school?
It's all of those things.
It's both.
Well, all of those things. It's about the nature of, well, there is an issue which I'll come on to, which is about what the high school entrance exams then do to the nature of what you're learning once you get into a school.
Yeah.
So I'll come on to that. But it's both, basically. Okay, so that's a kind of mixed view on the 1970s and what happened there. Yeah.
Was the admission process to high schools based on catchment areas, or...?
It was initially random. Well, the high school education policy, high school equalisation policy, made it an assignment by random lotteries. It moved away from a system of entrance exams towards random lottery allocation within geographic localities, basically. But they've moved away from that again. It's just what I'm going to come on to, basically. Interviewees of all political persuasions in my study, however, did say that 1970s high school equalisation in Korea, it had been one of a multitude of factors that had led to a reality where for some years Korean education has suffered from excessive sameness, excessive uniformity. It's been another factor feeding into that in Korea. And this was perceived as failing to cater, it may equalise, but it also fails to cater for student diversity. It fails to cater for diverse needs. And that failing to cater for diverse needs may in itself be a driver of private tutoring, that what makes parents want to spend more. And the importance of this notion of horizontal diversity was something that was stressed by interviewees ranging from national government politicians, national politicians, policy advisors, right through to left-wing NGO activists and teacher union reps and so on. this idea of horizontal diversity, allowing some specialisation in education along the lines of talents and interests. So this is a published quote from Juho Lee, who was a former conservative, a former education minister in the conservative regime, said, "Educational programmes and services should be diversified in order to address students' diverse needs. The structure of the system should be horizontal and diversified, allowing for an increase in relevance of educational opportunities by promoting equity and excellence simultaneously." Okay, so a focus on diversity, but also a focus on equity. And then this is a left-wing NGO activist said, "Nowadays, people don't want to go back to the era of prestigious high schools and lower high schools to hierarchy, but they do want customised curriculums." So some modest support for the idea of choice and diversity there, albeit within an equalised system, horizontal but not vertical differentiation, if you like. However, right, this is probably almost certainly the most important finding in the research project, and this is about the clear unanimity with which interviewees of all political persuasions in my study viewed reintroductions in recent decades of academically selective forms of diverse high schooling as contributing to dramatically increased private tutoring costs from the 1990s that can be seen in Korea, seen quite clearly, a rise in private tutoring costs from the 90s onwards. So since the 1980s in Korea, there have been these schools called special purpose high schools. They specialise in areas like languages and in sciences. They are permitted to select students academically. Currently, they make up about 6% of all Korean high schools. Since the late 2000s also, there have been emergence of other new forms of autonomous schools, autonomous public and autonomous private schools, that also have power to select students academically again, so deviating away from the past high school equalisation regime. Now, developments here do coincide with, in the 1990s in Korea, that was when the ban was lifted. So when a ban gets lifted, you would expect some increase in spending, at least some on-record increase in spending on private tutoring, as data it becomes more emergent of how much people are actually spending. However, it was still quite surprising in my study to hear both conservative and left-wing interviewees saying the same thing, which is that these selective school types, that they had created pressure for more extensive tutoring than ever before, and at students from younger ages than ever before in the education system. And they primarily viewed this as a problem. So here's another quote from another left-wing NGO person saying, "The rise of special purpose high schools, which require students to have higher academic credentials and scores, the rise of private tutoring has become really big." And this, again, is a former Conservative minister. "There was a big increase in private tutoring for middle school students because of very tough questions in entrance exams by foreign language schools, tough questions given by science high schools. To prepare for those difficult exams, you need private tutors." There's a very clear linkage. Now, the sort of underpinning story of this is that, and the key perspectives that came out were that although special purpose high schools in Korea had been intended to be something that would introduce some horizontal diversity in Korean high school, so centres of excellence in science or languages specifically, instead of that, after a period of equalisation, all parents could really see was that these were schools that were once again viewed as elite. It was a chance to go to an elite high school rather than a specialised high school. And that would give their children competitive advantage in the future. So special purpose high schools, they became flooded with students of all varieties and all aptitudes, not just the language and the science students. Everybody wanted to go to a special purpose high school. And what that led to was, one academic talked about questionable curricular identity in these schools. Just generally they were viewed as elite, but also in terms of being able to filter out the most able students, the exams, the entrance exams got harder and harder over time, more difficult. And what that ultimately led to, it said, is that there was content in those exams that one couldn't technically learn unless one deployed a private tutor. they were going beyond the standard middle school curriculum. So there was no other way to access those schools, which led to escalating private tutoring costs. One Minju politician in my study talked about the English crazy storm. The English crazy storm was foreign language high schools that were expecting really very high levels of standards of English speaking in the students, and so they had to have extensive private tutoring in order to achieve that. And one academic, this relates to the point you were talking about in the schools, one academic also pointed to the fact that when students have reached that level of achievement prior to getting into a school, once they get there, the curriculum has to be a bit more advanced for them, otherwise they'd be going backwards. So they have to keep paying for the private tutors. The private tutoring carries on throughout high school. It doesn't diminish particularly. Well, that's the academic's opinion anyway. And Kim and Shin have done a study that backs some of this up. It shows positive associations between the gradients at which private tutoring expenditures escalate over time, and whether or not students are, whether they are or whether they aren't aspiring to enter a special purpose high school, so that the spending goes up at a different rate where they are. And what all this has led to in Korea has been policy efforts in the last decade to actually reduce rather than increase academic selection. There have been moves against academic selection for a second time in Korean society, reintroducing forms of control on selection. And notably, these have been put in place by conservative governments. Okay. So since 2009 in Korea, the special purpose high schools have actually been prevented from administering their own entrance exams. They're still permitted to select students academically. However, they're only allowed to do it on the basis of middle school records. They're not allowed to have these separate, very difficult tests. They have to have middle school records and only in the relevant subjects within the middle school records. So, for example, languages and science. Private schools these days, the private schools that were banned from having the entrance exams, they can now have their own separate entrance exams. However, there are quite major restrictions on what those exams can do. They can only test for a general aptitude for learning, which is a questionable concept, which has been criticised a lot, but generally they're meant to move away from testing in detail on specific academic subjects. Public autonomous schools have the same restrictions. However, they've also got to additionally reserve 20% of their places for students from disadvantaged backgrounds, so a quota there as well. And within areas like Seoul, we've also seen new high school types that are celebrated as promoting horizontal diversity in Korean education. They are diverse pedagogies, but really making a point about not being academically selective as well. So no entrance exam, but still diverse. Of course, what we are seeing here is clearly not a complete banning of academic selection in Korea. And it is also worth noting that the more conservative interviewees that I spoke to, particularly from the conservative NGOs that I spoke to, they were still in favour of selective schooling, even though they did acknowledge that it clearly contributes to rising private tutoring costs. They said, well, we still support that policy. So there is still diversity of opinion, but what the unanimity is over, it's the fact that it does increase private tutoring costs. That's what they say. However, at the same time, many interviewees did also stress that there is some growing consensus in Korea in left-wing and right-wing policy circles between trying to move away from that concept of there being elite selective schools. And just a final couple of quotes here, again, from left and from right. It's not really popular in Korea. We've had much bigger problems with private tutoring compared to the UK, so we all know the problem if we're leaning to that kind of system. And then the next one. We Koreans have a pretty negative view of those entrance exams. Since Koreans are spending one-fourth of their household income on private education, they even lack the money to prepare for their old age. So regardless of which party, the politicians agree on the point that this is a very serious issue in Korea. They've been focusing on how to reduce the private tutoring costs. And these autonomous high schools, they're increasing the private tuition market. And so they're trying to move away towards abolishing those types of schools. So that's quite a clear message that actually these elite schools are not popular in Korea. They're seen as something that to move away from, seen as a bad thing. Okay, so by way of conclusion then, quite strong beliefs can be seen in Korea that returns to selective schooling from the 1980s onwards, make more mixed picture before then, but from the 1980s onwards, returns to selective schooling have been viewed as significantly fueling higher private tutoring costs. Education policymakers in England might want to pay attention here. They might want to take heed of this trend. Given current plans to expand academic selection, and given the very clear unequal capacities that families have to pay for that private tutoring. Now, that's not to say that there is going to be a Korean-style explosion of private tutoring in this country. There are many reasons why that might not be the case. It will be tempered by the fact that England is a very different society to South Korea. However, it's not without its own inequalities. It's not without its own forms of education fever. And notably, too, we do have falling public spending in this country on education, in real terms. One final point I want to note as well here is that how things do progress in England may also depend on how any future expansion of specialist of selective schooling in this country might be designed. There are some issues about what different designs of future selective education would involve. So one of these, for example, would be, would the difficulty levels of entrance exams that were put in place, to what extent could they be nationally regulated? At the moment, they're not regulated on a national level. The 11 plus is not a nationally uniform test in England. Worth noting as well that academy schools in England, privately run academy schools, are not currently bound by national curriculum requirements, and that might make quite a big difference. In the last year, there has been some debate focused on the possibility of future selective schooling operating some sort of quota for disadvantaged groups, perhaps a slightly lower entrance mark for disadvantaged groups. We have seen some examples of that in Korea. It's not clear what sort of impact it would have, but it could be something that in theory could contribute to lower private tutoring costs for some groups. Lastly, there has been some discussion in England about the concept that there is such a thing as a smart entrance exam, which is tutor-proof, that sees past the coaching and just sees the true potential of the child. Now, scepticism exists both in England and Korea with respect to how far any such test could ever exist. And I'm just going to leave you here with a quote from a Conservative minister in Korea that said that, basically very sceptical about this, he said, "Whatever test experts developed, there is no test that is beyond the reach of the private tutoring industry once that industry has taken hold in a society." It's a bit chilling, it says. "The private education market evolves. They understand the changing environment and they try to defeat the system. It's called anxiety marketing. They say, if you don't send your kids to private institutes, your child will be left behind. And the government and the business compete, but the private market is more powerful at persuading parents. The government cannot control the private education market." So I'll leave you with that thought.
Thank you so much. We have time for questions. We had a few, so let's jump in.
Yeah, hearing about this makes me very anxious to hear anything about testing and standardized tests. That takes me back. So I got a couple of things, but I guess the big question, if part of what you're trying to do is explain the rise of private tutoring and this education or the private tutoring fever, I'm surprised you didn't say much about the quality of public education, just not for these examinations, but just the quality of state schools in Korea. And I'm wondering whether the rise in private tutoring is related to the quality that the kids are getting. Is it the case that the tests, these university tests, are so delinked from anything the schools, the teachers teach in their classes, that it's a completely different system? Or is it basically it's maths, it's literacy, the same kinds of things that if the schools were better, they'd be getting for free? And I guess related to that is the incentive effects of all of this. Because if you're a public teacher and you know, you maybe you're in a union, you're not going to, your salary is kind of set, but you want to make some extra money.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't need to do a very good job
mm-hmm.
during the school hours.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it might be in your interest to do a terrible job,
mm-hmm.
and then you tell the parents in the parent-teacher meetings that, yeah, your son
mm-hmm.
isn't doing very well, your daughter's not doing very well, but I could help them,
mm-hmm.
given how rubbish the education they're getting in my classroom during
yeah.
the day.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's part of what's going on. So maybe say something about the quality of
yeah.
of state education generally, and whether that has anything to do with
mm-hmm.
the quality or
yeah.
the amount and the anxiety of the private
mm-hmm.
tutoring.
Yeah. I mean, this is something, I suppose, I'm presenting here a subset of findings that were the specific stuff that was said about about selective schooling, but
okay.
the bigger project was looking at a whole range of factors that have affected things. And
yeah.
I mean, questions, massive questions abound about the quality of Korean public schooling. But there are very mixed opinions about how you measure that quality and who you're talking to as well. So if you speak to representatives from the private tutoring industry in Korea, they will say, well, the quality is terrible in public, so no wonder they have to come to us. You know, I mean, it's, you know, but the teachers are lazy, the unions are too powerful, and so on and so on. And that's quite a popular perspective in the private tutoring industry. If you speak to the teacher unions, that's not what they say. They say the curriculum is so oppressive in Korea. There's such an extensive amount in the curriculum. There's no scope for creativity. There's no scope for student-centred learning because the curriculum's too packed. And so that constrains the quality. That constrains what teachers can do in the classroom. So there are debates about, you know, one, what the quality is and why. And if the quality is problematic, then why is it problematic? Korea is not a society that is underachieving in education. Obviously, in the PISA scores, it's doing well. But there, the issue is, you know, is that because so much is being spent on private tutoring? In terms of if the public middle schools were doing their job better, as it were, in order to access these schools, they wouldn't have any problem with these entrance exams. It's an argument. I mean, I think it's possible. However, what the impression I got was that these tests have become more and more difficult. I mean, very difficult. Not and beyond. I mean, there are questions about what we can reasonably expect a 15-year-old to be able to do, and what is at what point does high achievement stop? What is an appropriate level for a 15-year-old to know? But my impression is that it's very advanced. These tests are very advanced, what they're being asked to do at age 15, compared with what 15-year-olds in the UK would be asked to do, for example. So, yeah, you can call it low quality or you can call it crazy high quality, you see.
There's more questions I want to get to these, but about the incentives. So are the teachers also the tutors, or are they two separate groups? I thought that was an interesting point.
Teachers have been banned from being private tutors.
Okay, so
public school teachers, because of the problem of incentives, and there have been problems in other societies and originally in Korea as well, where, you know, there were all sorts of messed up incentives created by teachers tutoring their own students outside, and then they've got an incentive not to work so hard in the classroom and so on. However, that sort of demarcation has been made quite clear in Korea that, you know, you're not allowed to do that at the same time anyway. You can go between the sectors, but not simultaneously.
So Tim was first, and then we're going to have, there was a two here and then yourself after that. But we'll,
You said a lot about access to sort of middle schools and high schools, but I'm wondering if the comparison between England and Korea might be better at access to universities, particularly private money spent on, say, getting kids to Oxbridge in the UK or Sky universities in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could maybe make that comparison or talk a little bit more about how private money spent on education factors into university access in South Korea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's huge, is the answer. I think, yes, again, another huge part of what I discovered out there that I haven't been able to talk about today is the huge numbers of issues around and the reorganising and the reordering and the changing methods of selecting students for university. But it's definitely fair to say that that kind of tradition of, you know, the Sky universities are that this is sorry the Seoul National University, Korea University, and Yonsei. The Sky universities in Korea are a bit like the Oxbridge of Korea, and the money spent and the pressure to get into those universities is huge. There is vast private tutoring spending. Some conservative groups would argue that, you know, when they abolished the high school entrance exam, it just meant there was no earlier filtering mechanism. And so the pressure, like I say, that balloon effect just increased the pressure for college entrance exams. That's a view. That's not necessarily a proven point. Yes, my impression, I'm speaking from opinion here, my impression is that the pressure to get into specifically those three universities, the very fine-grained understanding that Koreans have of the reputation of different universities, seems to be, to me, to be more restrictively focused on the Sky universities than here. It seems to me that, you know, there are lots of universities that are considered good here, and it's not seen as such a failure to not get into Oxbridge here as it often is with the Sky universities in Korea. But that's an impression I couldn't confirm or deny, really. I mean, that's my view. But, yeah.
My impression is that, you know, elite schools want to have wealthy and smart kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they make these very hard exams just to sort students, you know, from those, you know, to pre-select this group of students.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously then the exam is kind of form as a signal, like it's a way for a smart or wealthy student to signal to the school, look, I'm the guy you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit pessimistic with this, you know, recent changes, that if you simply, you know, make exam less informative to those schools, if you make it easier, or you know, do not make it, like, let's say, tutor-proof, so then your students will simply use some other signals, and then maybe now, at the end of the day, maybe the mm-hmm. private tutoring itself will be a signal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this, maybe these kids will pay a lot of money, stay there until midnight,
mm-hmm.
do nothing, but just to signal to the selected school that, you know, we are better men.
Yeah.
Or maybe they will, you know, start doing something else.
Mm.
And so maybe that's my question, whether, so we have these two types of private tutoring. The one is which you can call remedial,
mm-hmm.
like someone which tries to correct, you know, let's say, put you back on the track, but one is which is kind of like enrichment, which
mm-hmm.
actually tries to, like, put you above the curriculum.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Accelerated learning.
Yeah, so I mean, you, like, kind of, like, based on the interviews, do, like, see maybe in a shift in like, what type of private tutoring has been offered?
I mean, I haven't been looking so much, I haven't done this study longitudinally, I'm looking now, but if you look at work by, for example, Mark Bray, who is kind of one of the big names in talking about, writing about private tutoring, he said, in the world, you are seeing a shift. In many countries, you're seeing a shift from it's been a smaller phenomenon, and it's been a phenomenon with a remedial focus. Kids that are falling behind deploy a private tutor. What has changed is the growth of private tutoring as a means of competitive advantage, as a means of accelerated learning. So I think you're right about that. I too would share your scepticism about how far messing around with what the tests will do anything in terms of equalising access, because this final quote about this, the private tutoring system adapting as well, there are huge debates with the college entrance system in Korea, saying, well, if we try and take into account extracurricular activities and not just performance in these top subjects, if we try and test general aptitude for learning, if we test by interview rather than a written exam, you know, that gives people more scope for accessing and, you know, makes it fairer. But there are all sorts of ways that tutors can coach you to be better at interviews. There are all sorts of ways that they can coach you, and that coach you to. There are actual private tutors specialised in how to make your CV look better in terms of extracurricular stuff. We will tell you exactly what extracurricular volunteering to do, and at what ages it looks good, and it's amazing. The coaching you can get on sort of making your CV look good generally.
Do students actually put on their CV, like, that they had this private tutoring? Like, does it actually use the fact that itself that they take this private?
They're certainly not required to, but they.
Kind of, you know, are they doing that?
I studied with the top private tutor.
Yeah.
Quite possibly, I couldn't say for sure, but there are certainly celebrity private tutors in Korea, and they, yeah, and actually that was one of them. I can't remember his name, but here he is. This guy. Celebrity private tutors are very famous for their. The online services, and it may be that, you know, if you've kind of studied with one of the top of the top, but actually the online stuff is not seen as high status as the one-to-one tutors who, you know, operate in Dachidong and Gangnam, and they come to your house, and they're basically big names, and if you've deployed those, but it may be a selling point, it may be a way that you can enhance your CV to sort of, you know, name drop a tutor. I don't know how often it's done though.
Thanks for your presentation. It's really, really informative. I also like the idea of sort of looking at an extreme case in a different society and sort sort of reflecting on how that informs our current situation here and certainly the future that we may be entering. Mm-hmm. But that also means that sort of your presentation breaks down into, you know, what is it that is the views of these experts and to some extent the public discussion in Korea,
mm-hmm.
that's one thing, right? Then sort of what is the actual sort of structural analysis of what's happening here?
Mm-hmm.
And then third, sort of what kind of lessons can we draw from this for the UK? And
yeah.
I don't have anything to say about the first, but I did have a comment on the second and the third
mm-hmm.
Sort of question. And you mentioned the crowded labor market and such, but it may be sort of deserve a little bit more emphasizing.
Mm.
I think a student of mine did a thesis on part of these questions, and
mm-hmm.
I think it's about more than 80% of current students, high school students in Korea, that go on to get a university degree,
mm-hmm.
Which is higher than any other country in the world.
Yep.
80%
yeah.
Get a university degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have overwhelmingly sort of overcrowded labor market, which means that the degree of educational inflation in this country has reached, you know, extremes,
mm-hmm.
Leading to a structural situation where
mm-hmm.
any rational person
mm-hmm.
Will invest as much as they can
yep.
in getting just a little bit more than their neighbors,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So getting into the right sort of feeder schools and then getting into the right university, those sky universities,
mm-hmm.
right? And that having that degree or not having a degree is enormously consequential for your opportunities, and that's, I think, also why you see a lot of Koreans actually leaving Korea
mm-hmm.
to get their education abroad,
mm-hmm.
right, to sort of acquire different sets of credentials in the U.S. or
mm-hmm.
elsewhere in
mm-hmm.
the U.K.,
mm-hmm.
Or just look for jobs,
mm-hmm.
sort of like opt out of the market altogether,
mm-hmm.
right? So if we look at it from the structural sort of positional
yeah.
good perspective, positional education, you get a slightly different analysis where a lot of the, you know, suggested changes obviously will have zero impact because they don't change that structural situation.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, people in sociology like the effectively maintained and the maximally maintained inequality
yeah.
sort of traditions have explored fruitfully in other settings.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be that this is just another case of that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, it's nothing new in
mm-hmm.
terms of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's just maybe a more extreme situation,
mm-hmm.
which maybe means that the comparison point here is not so much the entire UK, it's more like, let's look at a segment of the UK population where also getting into university itself is not that, you know, it's not that rare a thing, right? So if you zoom in
mm-hmm.
on sort of upper middle class or, you know, sort of,
mm-hmm.
so maybe it makes more sense to sort of look at what are the kind of situations that we can find
mm-hmm.
in this and other settings that
mm-hmm.
bear some resemblance with that structural situation rather than think of the policy implications for the country as a whole.
Mm.
And on that point, I also looked at, I don't know what statistics you drew from, I looked at OECD and public expenditure on education, according to OECD, is actually higher in Korea than it is in the UK.
When you include higher education, yeah. When you,
yeah, it yeah. breaks down, but
and
it's,
year,
it's
yeah.
quite comparable.
No, yeah, no,
that,
yeah, oh,
that
it
seems
is.
To be the case that
yeah, yeah, yeah.
it's
no, I mean,
lower.
OECD, yeah, it spends more than France and Germany. And
okay,
it's,
yeah,
it's, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And private expenditure in education is higher, actually, in the UK than it is in Korea. It's just that some of them is compensated for by shadow education, again, according to OECD statistics.
Spending on private education is higher in the UK.
Yeah, so it's 4.8, almost 5% in the UK, and 4% in Korea.
Is that including tuition fees?
Yes,
right,
but,
yeah,
but
yeah.
not shadow education.
Yeah. Ah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Not shadow education,
yeah.
but yeah, inside institutions.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right about all of that. I would say that, yeah, I mean, you're right. I haven't sort of gone into depth on the structures of job opportunities in the two countries, and I suppose you'd want to sort of think about. I mean, that is, again, coming back to this, you know, how comparable are the situations? Yes, I mean, it's definitely true that in Korea, this competition is created by very real competition for, I mean, working for the top three employers, basically, in Korea. That's, you know, kind of, everybody wants to work for you know, Samsung and so on. But I think you're right. I mean, there's only so much I can cover in this study. I think there are growing issues of qualification inflation in this country. I mean, as we see higher education access expanding, and you know, it's increasingly becoming an issue not to go to university in this country as participation increases, particularly with the loans and the change in funding. growing numbers of people needing master's degrees for jobs that used to be you only need an undergraduate degree. It's not the same degree as Korea, I agree, and that's, I mean, there are, that's why I'm making this massive caveat of, you know, there are limits to how far this is comparable. But I think that there are interesting cultural developments in both places that, you know, you see growing obsession with, you know, qualifications, I suppose, and, you know, this middle class fear of falling that's been written about. And I was very surprised. I was, oh, it's Korean. It's very Korean to be obsessed with education. It's very Korean to be obsessed with you know, qualifications and making sure that you're achieving an education. I thought, well, we are seeing this here. It's just maybe not on the same level. But I don't know what the future is going to hold for this. Right? I mean, yeah.
Great.
Thanks a lot for the very interesting presentation. I have a question on whether from the interview data you got a little bit like a sense of the politics behind that is kind of underpinning this system of selective schooling and private tutoring, which mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting from your presentation, that it seems like everybody agrees that the system has massive kind of negative externalities, mm-hmm. and yet it's persistent, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether that has to do with the fact that given the kind of societal incentive structure that mm-hmm. was just pointed out, politicians just didn't figure out what could be the policy solution, like mm-hmm. a proper policy solution to this, mm-hmm. Or whether there are some kind of strong organized interests that kind of mm-hmm. sustain this, what seems mm-hmm. to be a highly ineffective yet persistent system.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have any sense of any of this from the interview data.
Yeah, I think that there are clearly groups who benefit from this. There are clearly groups who, you know, kind of can afford that huge amount of private tutoring. But you do get the impression that there's a sort of almost huge collective action problem going on, that the society is almost stuck. Everybody knows it's terrible that this amount of money is being spent and that children are spending so many hours doing this, but nobody can see how to stop. And it's almost like it's taken on a life of its own in that way. Definitely the conservative parents groups, when you speak to them, they say, yes, well, I think it should increase because, you know, I know that my child will go to Seoul National University. So there are clearly powerful groups who, you know, are on the better end of this. But there are middle-class families making huge numbers of sacrifices, remortgaging their houses, you know, moving to smaller places, that, you know, you think, well, you know, you're living in a tiny flat because we have to take on a second mortgage to pay for the private tutoring costs. And that seems to be really widespread, so I'm quite surprised about, you know, the number of people whose interest it doesn't seem to be working in, basically.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about the kind of, I guess, slope between private tuition and, like, parental tuition, right? So mm-hmm. parents are very involved in supporting and coaching their children from mm-hmm. age, mm-hmm. and whether or not we have more of the latter in say, the UK and Anglo-Saxon societies, which might be taking that place of private tuition, and maybe there's something also about the types of selection exams that makes it harder or less hard for parents to kind of fill that role.
Mm-hmm. To
so
help
is
your own
there
kids.
A way of getting at sort of
what numbers of hours parents are spending
and
so on?
Yeah,
yeah.
Can this also be brought in house if you try and tackle it through,
well,
through caps on,
I suppose,
private tuition?
Caps on private tuition, yeah, well, the curfews and so on.
Yeah.
But then the parents would have to start tutoring at 10 p.m., so that is a thing. I mean, I think that some of the stuff, I mean, if private tutoring has got more and more advanced over time, and if accelerated learning has taken off in such a way over time, then it's quite possible that parents wouldn't be able to tutor kids in some of the things that those kids mm-hmm. are learning. The tutoring might be the other way around by that point, or, you know mm-hmm. stuff that adults have never covered that their children are now covering in terms of advanced learning. I would say in Korea they're working such long hours that I'm not sure when you work such long hours in order to pay for the private tutors. And there's also a very strong, this whole sort of cult of reputation thing that I'm talking about, that if you are, you know, there's such a premium placed on or such ascribed value, there's such value placed on, well, it's this specific private tutor, they're going to this incredibly high reputation hag one, they would never presume to be able to tutor to the same degree, and so it might be seen as, you know, a sort of second best solution to sort of tutor your child yourself when, you know, this incredibly reputable famous tutor can do a much better job than you can. I mean I don't know the data though in terms of, you know, how many hours, and I'm not sure how you find comparable data.
I guess. Now, I was thinking more that in the UK you might have the sort of in the family provision,
mm-hmm.
some
mm-hmm.
proxying, doing the same kind of thing that the private tuition is doing.
Possibly, although I'm not sure it'd be to midnight. But,
can I just get, I think this is a fundamental point, that the parents of these South Korean kids are not nearly as well educated. They can't do that math.
Yeah.
They can't you know, read and write.
I mean, about general generational parents. Ramping up. Or
so this is a new country where the parents aren't able to help their kids nearly to the same extent as British parents can, over and above tutoring. Just they're speaking a different language, the kids.
There are studies, and like, some studies have been done in the UK of parents' time use with this, and like what sorts of private tutoring and the quality of home learning environments, how much time parents are spending reading to their children in the UK. It might be worth me looking at kind of that data, going back to that data and looking at like what different parents are doing and how many hours they're spending doing it in the UK. Obviously, there are huge social class disparities and income disparities in how much time parents are spending reading to their children and helping them with homework. Again, literacy problems, numeracy problems among parents of more disadvantaged groups where they can't necessarily help their kids with homework as well. So a lot of issues in the mix there, I guess.
Carol,
this
is a presentation really interesting. I find it really interesting that there seems to be this continued belief that you can invest in your child's progression and then they can go to university and everyone's paying for private tutoring, which seems to counter the idea that people do have a natural ability because you can just invest into whatever you want to start to succeed. And yet they seem to be reverting back to an idea that there isn't a test for natural ability, so let's do away with these tests and have natural ability tests. And then I'm questioning whether or not there is such thing as a natural ability when you can teach your whole population to get to a university. And I just wonder how much, I don't know if your research touched on this, people are still wedded to the idea that there's a meritocracy and it's purely natural ability that's getting children to the top and to the elite universities. How much people acknowledge it's just about how much you spend, how much you invest.
Well, I suppose nobody knows how far natural ability is truly something in existence. I mean, like genetic ability can be like nature versus nurture. It does seem to me, you're right, an interesting contradiction that so much money would be spent on private tutoring and coaching your child at the same time as saying, well, we're going to go back to these tests that are just going to test for natural ability. I'm not sure how widespread the belief is in natural ability in Korean society or indeed here, but yeah.
There must believe that the society is still a meritocracy, though. Do they still believe that, you know, people are getting just outcomes for all this?
No, I don't think anybody believes that. Well, certainly when you speak to the parents' groups and they talk about the injustice of how much people can spend and the higher, and it does all seem to be, well, you know, they can afford this, so they will go there. They can afford this, so yeah. Natural ability doesn't come out in the interview findings much. It's more, you know, I live in this area, I can afford this private tutor, I can afford this many hours, and you know. People who live there go there, and so they're obviously going to go there. And it's not, yeah, it's, yeah. No, I don't think there's much belief in a meritocracy anywhere.
At least they're not conning themselves.
No, true.
Any other final questions? One more? Yeah.
Is it the case that the transition to democracy has led to more tutoring and more anxiety in Korean society? That's number one. And what happens to the unsuccessful candidates? Is there an increase in suicide, for example?
Yeah.
And is there a difference between the children of elite families versus the children of less advantaged families in terms of suicide?
Social class gradient and suicide, I don't know exactly, but I would imagine that there are certainly problems with the suicide rate among young people in Korea, and suicide is the number one cause of death among, I think, students aged 10 to 20. So it's a real problem, suicide in Korea, upon failing to get into the university, the top university of your choice. I would imagine there would be an income correlation with the suicide rates, but I don't know for sure. in terms of transition to democracy and whether or not this is, well, I mean, you've seen a move away from the likes of banning private tutoring and things, and you've seen a growth in private tutoring expenditures over time. Whether that can be causally linked to other features in society, it's coincided. I don't know what the causal links. I mean, it's very difficult to isolate and prove that and disentangle from other effects, but certainly, you know, there is an association there. The other thing to say is, after the ban in private tutoring was lifted, clearly you saw private tutoring costs going up, but no one really knows how much money was being spent in the time of the ban because you couldn't get reliable data, and it's quite possible that underground private tutoring would be more expensive because it's underground. So it's not clear what during the period of the ban, and as that ban was gradually relaxed, how reliable the data that they do have on private tutoring is.
Well, I tell you, we'll stop now. If you can ask afterwards, is that okay? But thank you again. If you can join me, and thank you so much.